Thank you. I very much appreciate that warm introduction. I wrote most of it. I do have to say it's better than the introduction I received the other day. I was speaking at an event and I was introduced as a speaker who needs no introduction, which is a good thing because I've never heard of him. But I want to talk to you a little bit about the welfare state today, and basically one of the things I want to get across is we don't realize just how big the welfare state has become. And we have, you know, of course, the welfare state for the poor, but that is, of course, dwarfed by the welfare states, let's say, for the elderly. We have corporate welfare. We have farm welfare. And we should realize that all these sort of welfares are all sort of a piece. And in fact, we now live in a society in which if you include people who receive benefits from the government, people who work for the government, directly government employees, and people who have contracts with the government, 52% of Americans receive more than half of their income from the government. So the American welfare state is really huge. But when we look at the consequences of this welfare state, I want to focus, if I can, on just one piece of it today, and that is the welfare state as regards the poor, because I believe the poor are the real victims, the biggest victims, if you will, of the American welfare state as it exists today. And the welfare state for the poor is also much larger than I think we believe. I mean, if you listen to most of the media reports that are out there today, you sort of think of welfare in America as being one step up from Marie Antoinette. I mean, we're just barely letting them sleep under bridges and eat cake. But the reality of it is that the welfare state is much, much bigger than that. The federal government alone today operates 126 anti-poverty programs, separate anti-poverty programs. And to define that, to call something an anti-poverty program here, I'm using either a program that is means-tested, which means by definition its benefits are going to lower-income people, or a program that says in the program definition, this is an anti-poverty program. So I think those are fair to count, and there's 126 of them. 72 of those provide benefits directly to individuals, either cash benefits or an in-kind benefit, food, housing, medical care, and so on. The remainder are sort of broader community-based anti-poverty programs, community development block grants, and things of that nature. All told, last year, the federal government spent on those 126 programs $688 billion. Billion with a B. That's federal spending. State and local governments spent an additional $293 billion on anti-poverty programs. That's a total of $981 billion. So we spent just barely under $1 trillion fighting poverty. This is not only an enormous amount of money, but it's a significant increase in welfare spending over the years. I mean, all told, if you go back to 1964, when Lyndon Johnson declared war on poverty, we have spent, in constant dollars, $19 trillion fighting poverty. We've gone from, back in 1966, which was, you know, Johnson declared war on poverty in 64, but it took a couple of years for all the Great Society programs to be passed and get started. So let's start in 66. That year, in constant 2014 dollars, we spent $160 billion. Today, it's nearly $1 trillion. In fact, if you want to look at it, we can say, okay, that's not adjusted for population, all that. So let's look at that same amount of spending on a per poor person basis. How much did we spend for each person in poverty? Well, back in 1966, we spent $6,972 for each person who was living below the poverty level. Today, we spend $21,113 for every person below the poverty level. And when you consider that the poverty level is around $13,000, you know, we could basically write everyone a check who is poor, stash the rest of the money and be better off. And what are we getting for that money? Using the conventional Census Bureau poverty numbers, in 1966, the poverty rate was 14.3%. Today, 2014, the poverty rate is 14.5%. So we've spent $19 trillion, and what have we really accomplished? The poverty rate is actually slightly higher today than it was when we began. Now, I do want to caution a little bit on using that number, because the poverty rate, pretty much everybody, regardless of ideology, believes that the poverty rate is a lousy measure of poverty. I mean, no one quite agrees on exactly how to measure it, but everyone agrees that that's a bad measure. The poverty rate is still based on three times the Agriculture Department's low-cost food plan. This was a poverty rate designed in the 1950s. And that, you know, it doesn't, for example, count in-kind benefits. It only counts cash. So TANF counts towards the poverty rate, but food stamps, free housing, Medicaid, and so on, none of that counts towards the poverty rate. So someone could have cash income below the poverty rate, receive lots and lots of benefits that raise their standard of living well above the poverty rate, but we'd still consider them poor. Also doesn't consider taxes. Someone could earn more than the poverty rate, have take-home pay after taxes that pushes them below the poverty rate, and we say they're not poor. In addition, spending has changed enormously. Very few people spend a third of their income on food anymore. Much more goes to housing and other things like that. So this poverty rate measure is not a very good one. The Census Bureau, therefore, has tried to come up with a supplementary poverty measure, or what's called an alternative poverty measure, which takes these things into account. And recently, several very good studies have been done, the best by Chris Weimer at Columbia University, but there's been some others out there as well, that have looked at using this alternative poverty measure and looking at that compared to poverty over time to see what we've accomplished. And they suggest that if you actually project this back in time, we have succeeded in lowering the poverty rate substantially since 1964, that the poverty rate really has come down since 1964. However, actually you've seen several of these studies that have been trumpeted on the left saying, see, welfare spending works. But if you actually look at these studies, what they show is that almost all the gains from the war on poverty occurred in the first 10 years after the war on poverty began. By 1974, the poverty rate, even using this alternative poverty measure, levels out and doesn't really change, despite the fact that spending increases significantly beginning around the mid-1970s, begins to really take off. So what you're seeing is almost no incremental gains from any of the additional welfare spending that we've seen, particularly the last spending over the last two administrations when it's really skyrocketed. We have not seen any incremental gains in reducing that poverty rate. In addition to that, there's reason to question whether or not it was the welfare programs that actually reduced poverty during those first 10 years. Because you have to remember several other things were going on simultaneously during that period. Number one, you had the Civil Rights Act passed in 1965, which had this tremendous impact as well on African-American earnings over this period. In fact, several studies show that what you had was that, particularly in the South, black earnings nearly caught up to white earnings in the 10 years immediately following passage of the Civil Rights Act, as African-Americans were able to, A, move into jobs, and B, begin to get wages that were comparable to whites as that occurred. That moved enormous numbers of African-Americans out of poverty, and in fact, you do see African-American poverty decline very sharply in those first 10 years. Second, at the same time, you also had the women's movement, which enabled women to begin to move into the labor force and also move into higher-paying jobs at the same time, just like African-Americans, and you begin to see female-headed households begin to have a decline in poverty over that period of time. That reverses, by the way. That female decline begins to reverse in the late 1970s, as you begin to have higher divorce rates, higher out-of-wedlock birth rates, and so on, begin to overtake the gains that went from the higher wages that women were receiving at that period of time. And the women's poverty rate begins to level out. African Americans continue to gain through the 1980s, although they get hurt very hard in the recent recession that was going on. So what we do know, so we can't really say whether or not welfare spending had benefits during the first 10 years, but it might have. Since then, we can say it's accomplishing almost nothing in terms of reducing poverty. That it currently increases in welfare spending are gaining us very little. The other thing we can say is that welfare spending is doing, if it might not be doing a lot of, it might not be doing any good, certainly not doing a lot of good, but it's also doing a certain amount of harm on the other end of it. We know, for example, we actually have a pretty good idea of what it takes to get out of poverty. Basically, three things. Number one, finish school. We know that if you're a high school dropout, you're going to be poor. If you're a college graduate, you're not likely to be poor for any length of time. Second, if you're not married, don't have a baby. I attach no moral judgment to this whatsoever. It is simply an economic judgment. You're five times more likely to be poor if you give birth out of wedlock than if you wait till you're married before you have children. And number three, get a job, any job, and stick with it, even a minimum wage job. Only 3% of Americans who work full-time live in poverty. In fact, even part-time work helps. Only about 15% of part-time workers live in poverty, compared to almost 30% of people without a job. So get a job. The welfare system we have established perversely discourages exactly those things that I just talked about. Education, we can talk a lot about the bureaucracy, the educational establishment, and the school choice movement, all those sorts of things, and why we need to reform the educational system. But certainly, there's been numerous studies that shows that the availability of welfare increases out-of-wedlock birth rates. Now, I will ask you one little caution on that. Most of the studies, in fact, almost all the studies were done prior to welfare reform, but they show overwhelmingly a relationship between out-of-wedlock birth and the availability of welfare benefits. There's been about three good studies since then. Two out of those three continue to show an out-of-wedlock relationship between the two. So we still are seeing that, but there's just not as much research as there once was. In terms of work, we know that welfare can provide an enormous level of benefits if people begin to game the system and collect them all. We looked at the Cato Institute. We looked at what in each of the 50 states, what would happen if a family, and we used a typical welfare family here of a mother with two children, and said, what if they collected the five or the seven most common welfare benefits? They got TANF, they got food stamps, they got Medicaid, they got WIC, they got public housing assistance through Section 8, they got the LIHEAP fuel program, and they also got free commodities, which is government cheese, so to speak. If they got those programs, we found that the benefit levels in 35 states exceeded what that family could earn from a minimum wage job. In 13 states, it was more than double the minimum wage. And in the 10 most generous states, you'd have to have a job that earned over $20 an hour to do as well as that family would do by collecting those welfare benefits. And remember, we're talking generally families that don't have an enormous amount of skills, attachment to the labor force, and so on. The type of jobs they get are going to be entry-level beginning jobs. They're not going to take off to starting at Microsoft as a computer programmer, by and large. So for these families, it's a very logical choice to choose welfare over work. You know, I see no evidence that people on welfare are lazy. In fact, if I look at survey after survey and interview after interview and the people I've talked to myself, all of them say people on welfare would prefer to work just as a matter of dignity. They also, by and large, those same surveys show that people on welfare aren't looking for work or taking jobs. Why? Because they're not lazy, but they're also not stupid. If you pay people more not to work than they can earn from working, they might not work. Look, I love my job. If anyone here wants to pay me two or three times what I'm currently getting, I'm willing to discuss retirement. Here in Michigan, just to give you an idea, someone on those seven benefits would collect about $28,872 in total benefits. That's the equivalent of a job paying $12.71 an hour. Is it any wonder that people aren't working? And we know that if you look at people on welfare and whether or not they work, despite the welfare reforms of the 1980s when we moved everyone, remember the Clinton welfare reforms, we moved everyone from welfare to work, the number of people who are receiving welfare benefits who are actually working is only 42% nationwide. And that's using a very broad definition of work. To meet that qualification for work, you can be in college, job training. In fact, looking for work, job search programs, looking for work, counts as work under that definition. And only 42% are. And that's the nationwide average. There are states, Massachusetts, only 17% of people on welfare are actually working by that definition. Missouri, 18%. New York State's around 22%, and so on. So we're talking about a lack of work on welfare, and yet we know that work is the root out of welfare. What we've established with our welfare system right now is a system in which we have succeeded, I think to some degree, in making poverty less uncomfortable. The sort of real destitution that went on in the 1960s, back in an era when people who were poor didn't have plumbing or electricity, that the sort of malnutrition that went on that Michael Harrington talked about in The Other America, that's gone. People on welfare are not starving to death in the streets. But we've also created a system under which they live as wards of the state, where they're dependent on the government and not able to become fully self-supporting, self-actualized people that they want to be and that we should seek to encourage them to be. We are creating a system under which people are infantilized when we treat them essentially largely as children. And we say, we'll give you a few dollars for food. Here's your allowance. Some money for food, a little money for rent, take care of your health care, and we expect nothing out of you in return. I think that is a system that is damaging to the poor as human beings. And I think that, more than all the other failures of the welfare state, the fact that we can't afford it, the fact that it's unfair to the people who have to support people who aren't taking care of themselves. All those failures are fine. But it's in what we do to the poor as human beings that the welfare state truly fails. And I don't think we make that point enough. When it comes to welfare, we're seen as cheap and mean. The fact is, we have the moral high ground here. We have created a system that destroys people. And that is simply wrong. Thank you very much.